All right, I think we're ready.
Okay.
So go ahead and get started. So the last question we left off on was actually just a general one. I had been asking you about your work history and your travels. And so the last question in that section is basically just I was going to ask you how your experiences at IBW influenced your work life after you left. Like, what kinds of things did you take away, and, you know, how did they help you through what sounds like a really fascinating career?
I think what it did for me was to make me very much aware of the African diaspora. Looking at, not just from a tourist, I rarely traveled as a tourist. I tended to travel more as a development specialist. So looking at clean, safe water, sanitation issues, access to education and health care. And so a lot of the projects that I worked on that related to my travel work projects that focused on particularly Africa and the African diaspora, but specifically development projects. So it ended up almost that even if I was doing something in education, it was always around advocacy and making sure of equity issues, the Women in Development projects, clean, safe water. So it wasn't tourism. I did do, you know, a couple of trips. I think I did two trips as a tourist. Like one time I went to South Africa with a group of friends. But even then it was still, you know, focusing on being around people and not just going to see monuments or things like that. So I think that was one of the impacts that not only IBW but the other types of experiences that I had had me having that type of focus.
Is there a memorable project that you, that like development project that you did in a specific country that you'd like to share?
I think the most fascinating for me was the projects that we had in Madagascar. At that time, I was at Clark Atlanta University, and we were in partnership programs with universities on the African continent. And, well, you know, Madagascar is not on the continent, but you understand what I'm talking about. Anyway, so we partnered with the University of Tomasina, which is the capital is Antananarivo, but we were in the rural area. And so their faculty would come to, like, Clark Atlanta University and their students, and we would send faculty and students to their university. And I would serve as the liaison between the two communities, school communities. And so one of the things we did at the university there was to install a technology center because Madagascar was coming out of coming into independence out of their relationship with the Soviets, and so their students didn't have access to some of the communication things that they would need in order to be successful. But what we also learned was business people wanted access to technology. So we actually put in, using USAID funding, a technology center. We put in women in development projects. A lot of their young people came to Clark Atlanta University, because that's where I was at that point. And so one was the person who got her master's degree in library science. And we felt that she would be a great person to come over because then she learned about all of the technologies and things like that and could take it back to her country. And then the person who was over there, Women in Development, came to Clark Atlanta University to study with Shelby Lewis. And I don't know if you know Shelby, but she's a major player in the Women in Development, and we had a business, the School of Business at Clark AU is amazing. So we had some of their business people to come over, and they didn't get a degree, but they did get a certificate. And so it was just, you know, that was fascinating to me to be in the rural area of Madagascar. And when I say rural, I'm talking really rural. and to see the biodiversity, of course, that was amazing. Mm. Mm-hmm. And so, and to meet people who were just so different from us. I remember once the Minister of the Environment, who was a female, came to Atlanta. And when I was there, I stayed at her home. And so I invited her to stay at my home. But see, I'm not the minister of anything. And one day we got a knock on the door. We were just in the house just laughing. And it was kind of like her bodyguard saying, she can't stay here. You know, she can't stay in a private home. She has to stay in a more secure space.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't even thought about those kinds of issues because, you know, we just enjoyed each other's mm-hmm. company and families and things like that. And so meeting people, having those types of development experiences and feeling like not only are you doing the right thing, but you could see the differences, you know, when somebody has a degree and has new skills and can take it back to their community. Just mm-hmm. those kinds of experiences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Thank you.
So I'm going to shift a little bit and ask some questions about your family, if that's okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Where is your spouse from?
Jamaica.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Where and how did you meet?
Walking down the street in Atlanta.
Really?
Hi. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a long story, so we aren't going to go there. You had too many long stories.
Well, I am okay with that, if you would like to share it. But so you guys just kind of met? Just what?
No, we didn't. I actually moved from Washington to Atlanta. I had a girlfriend whose sister was a seer, like Pat Daly is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she told me to sell everything in my apartment, get rid of the car that I was driving because it wasn't healthy for me, and to pack up all my things and to move to Atlanta, and that I would meet my husband to be walking down the street, and I would know it immediately. So I put up signs all over my community. I had an apartment sale. I moved to Atlanta on the train with my little baby daughter and a suitcase.
Mm.
And I took the job that I told you about at Clark AU.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one day I was walking to class, and this guy walked past me and said hi, and I said hi to him. I looked back, and he was looking back, and I said, smiled at him and said hi again. And the third time that we looked at each other, that was it. A year later, we were married, and we've been married for 30 years.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And he was a visiting professor at Atlanta University, but he ended up being a dean and staying.
Yes.
He just retired.
Yes, yes, yes. I remember you're talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's been amazing. That gives me hope. I'm still
single,
so I'm like, I would like to meet someone.
Yes, well, that's exactly what you say. I would like to meet somebody and let your behavior be open to meeting somebody.
Mm.
And you don't meet people in your living room. You meet them out in the world. So sometimes I have to tell women that because they hang around with women or they stay inside. I say, no, I don't think that's how you meet people.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. So actually, in about a week, I'll be traveling. And I'm an anxious traveler, like super anxious. I don't like to be outside my comfort zone very often. And so,
Where are you going?
So I'll be going to London Oxford for about 7 days for a writing workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a writer's residency at a colony like outside Chicago. So then I'll go straight from London to Chicago I'll stay there for a couple of days, and then I'll go to the residency, which is about an hour outside the city. So I'll be gone for a few weeks.
Well, there are a lot of attractive men in London from all over the world. So just wear something bright and smile.
I will take that advice. Oh, my goodness. So you said you, after about a year, you got married. What was the dating like? What was the courtship like, if you want to share that?
Fun. You know, he's the type of person who's very even. He's traveled a lot. He ended up being the program officer for the Madagascar project. So I think it is really interesting that, like, I gave birth to his, and the Cameroon project, I gave birth to our son, like, on a Friday in the following week. The son, my daughter, and I were in the Cameroon for 4 months.
Wow.
Because he had this, somebody, he says, oh, you can do it. I was like, okay, I'll go. So I was there doing development work for a project that came out of the School of Education for my husband, because he says, I got to send somebody. You're the one. I said, okay, I'm gone. Bye. But it was, you know, he was very even, very nice, very, you know, very bright. We worked a lot together on projects. And, you know, I call him my secretary because he loves to do the research and the background stuff. And I can ask him, I said, can you find this and this and this and this? And he'll just like, oh, yeah. Then we'll talk about it. And so, very healthy relationship.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's fine.
Good. And his profession, you said he worked in the Department of Social Work?
No.
At Clark Atlanta?
No, he's in educational leadership.
Oh.
So I'm in education and I train educators. He trains principals and school district personnel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Did your parents or family have any opposition to your marrying him? And his,
No, everybody thought he shouldn't marry me.
Oh.
They loved him. It's me that's problematic. My brothers were like, man, you don't need to marry her. She doesn't cook. She doesn't clean. You know, why would you marry this girl? They were like, we can find you somebody. She can't do anything.
Interesting. And let's see. And you said you have, how many children do you have?
We claim 4.
Okay.
He had a daughter, and I had a daughter when we married.
Mm-hmm.
We adopted a little girl out of Jamaica, and we have a son.
Wow.
So the son is the connecting for all of them. And in fact, on the 27th of July, we'll all be in New York. My Arlene is coming from Toronto with her daughter. Lona lives in New York. My daughter, Amber, lives in New York. And Marcus lives here with his 2 daughters. And everybody's going to New York to celebrate Trevor's 80th birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're all excited. We're going to have a weekend. His birthday's on a Thursday. We're going to be there Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And then I have to leave on Sunday to go to a conference in D.C.,
Do you have, like, events planned? Are you going to,
Yeah.
I don't know.
We're going out to dinner. We have a restaurant picked out. There will be 16 of us at dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going on Friday night to see a play. And then on Saturday we're doing a dinner cruise. And, you know, we always have brunch at Serafina's before we, you know, leave New York. And so we'll do that on Sunday. And we're catching the train because the idea is my husband, he loves trains, and so we do a lot of traveling by train. And so he wanted to do the Acela. He's never done it. So we're going to get off the train from Atlanta in D.C., catch the Acela, and then catch the Acela back to D.C. for my conference. So that is his birthday present for me, is the Acela train ride.
Oh, wonderful. I don't know a lot about train travel. So is that like a...
That's a bullet train. That's a train that you get on in D.C. and like a half hour later you're in New York.
Oh, really?
You haven't heard about it?
I have not.
You can catch it and go across the country in the opposite direction. I told him that we're going to do that too. Since now he's retired, we can plan those kinds of, you know, mm-hmm. being away for a week, 10 days, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing, because most people tell me it takes a few hours to get from New York to D.C. and vice versa by train.
If you do the regular train, yeah, but we're going to do that bullet.
Oh, wow.
He's excited.
Yeah, well, that was exciting. That's awesome. Okay, so you said you have some grandchildren. How many do you have?
The daughter in Toronto has one little girl. The young lady we adopted who lives in the Bronx, she has one little boy. And then my son here has two little girls.
Oh, cool. And what are your grandchildren like?
They're bad. I try to spoil all of them as much as I can.
Wonderful. What about your children? I know you mentioned that your son acts in plays, or
he's an opera singer.
Oh, wow.
Mhm.
Wow. What about your other children? Are they also in the arts, or do they?
I have a daughter who was on Broadway. That's the daughter who lives in New York. Mm-hmm. She also, you know, they all have other things that they do, because you know, being an artist, you can starve to death or you can work other things. So she also she's the director of communications for the School of Optometry of the SUNY system.
Mm-hmm.
And my other daughter is in HR, the one who lives in Toronto. She's an administrator, an HR administrator. And then our little daughter, who we adopted from Jamaica when she was 7, is a cancer nurse at Sloan Kettering.
Mm.
So they're all productive young people.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful. Wonderful. When you adopted your daughter, was it like a family thing, or did you just make a decision that you wanted to adopt? Like, was it?
No, she was one of my husband, before teaching at Clark AU, had taught at the University of the West Indies.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his students was killed in an automobile accident, and we were here, you know, he had since left Jamaica, and we received a phone call from one of her neighbors telling us that not only had the accident happened, but the man that she was married to, the student, had left, because even though she was married to him, the daughter was not his daughter. And so the family next door knew that we were acting as godparents for this little girl. And she called us and said, you know, Dr. Turner, you need to come home and check on your goddaughter, because we think she's in the house by herself. And at that time, she was 7. So he flew down, and then he called me on the phone, and I said, Bringer, what difference does one more make? And so we went through all of the necessities of getting her here and all of that.
Mm. Oh, wow. Amazing.
So she's been ours since she was 7.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So with having children, I know you talked a little bit about like giving birth and then like being in camera room the next week. And you certainly had a husband who supported your like travels and all of the wonderful things you did. But did you ever find that it was difficult to like raise a family and do all of the things you did with?
No,
you know?
All my kids, regretfully, when I say, "Hey, let's go," they don't say like, "No, mommy, I need it." They say, "Okay, when? When are we leaving?"
Mm-hmm.
And right now, like we were, you know, planning the trip in New York, for example. And one had said, Marcus, the one who's here, said, "Oh, Mom, you know, I think I have a conflict." He canceled his stuff so quickly. He says, "No, I'm going." You know, they like to go, you know, know, even like last week or so, my daughter was in Europe, and I was like, you know, I'm not too comfortable about this. And she says, hey, she said, things happen in New York. So she says, I don't know. I don't remember where all they went. They went to places. I think they went to Paris and one other place. And I was like, really, don't tell me because, you know, I don't want to be worried about you. Just have a good time. Let me know when you get back. So the daughter who now lives in Toronto, the last time we saw her was when she was living in Grenada. You know, it's just what it is.
Mm. Oh, wow. Yeah. So they too are just very open about travel and living in other places.
Oh yeah, it is, and I love that because I want them to feel that way.
So this is our last. Well, I think we have a.
Yay!
I have one more section and then sort of concluding thoughts, but. So I'm just going to go back to a quote that Dr. Harding said in the 70s, which is the vast majority of the Black institutions we need are yet to be born. And also, and I know I've mentioned this earlier, but during our initial conversation, you said to me that institutions die only when people let them die. And I just wanted to ask you, in terms of institutions, how much do you think has changed since the 1970s, particularly since you work for organizations that promote you know, like community development and like the arts and all of those things. Like, do you feel like we're further along in, you know, building important institutions?
You know, it's really, this is an interesting question coming from you. I worked for 20 years for the National Black Arts Festival as their director of education. And that particular institution, in terms of its fundamental mission, has disappeared.
They're
still in office. They do a gala. They do some other programming. But when I worked at the festival, there would be, I could program a concert, and there would be maybe 50,000 people who would show up. We would take over the entire Centennial Park. I would do programming for children. Like, let's say one day I brought in Ashley Bryan. Do you know the children's out there, Ashley Bryan?
The name sounds familiar.
He's amazing. He's almost like maybe 90-some years old now, but he's still amazing. And, like, I brought him in, and we had, for his birthday, and we had 5,000 children show up for it. That was, to me, the National Black Arts Festival. Mm-hmm. Now to see them having a gala and doing a little seminar here and maybe a dance program that 200 people would go to, it's like, are you really serious? So I think that, you know, it would be one thing, and I know things have natural lifespans, but it's also, I think, important for us to do like the autopsy. Why did this fail? Why did something so fundamental and so critical, not only to the African-American community, but to the African diaspora, because vendors would come in from all over the diaspora, performances from all over the diaspora would gather in Atlanta every year. And it would be amazing. When I moved here, I went, you know, just kind of like to enjoy it. And I knew that I had to be somehow connected with it. So I, you know, went to the director and I said, you need me. You know, kind of Stephanie Huey. I don't know if you know Stephanie. Stephanie's amazing. And I went to her and just said, you need me. She says, I was the craziest person she ever met in her life. But she realized that she really did. And I worked very hard to develop a children's programming, a youth program, you know, where interns from colleges could come and work in the summer. And, you know, just to say you've got, it wasn't people from outside of the organization. It was people internal to the organization who failed the organization. But there are other institutions here. One of the other places that I worked for, and I still have a very wonderful relationship with, is Families First. I don't know if you know the Families First name. But it's, basically it was built 150 years ago on the Spelman's campus. And a lot of people don't know that it was built as a result of children post the Civil War who could not go back home, had no homes to go to, so this place was, you know, established. And it still operates, it still does adoptions, foster care, you know, just all kinds of service agency. And I served as their education advocate. As one of my, you know, not part-time jobs, but one of the jobs that I don't have to go to every day. I, you know, if they call me and say there's a child who needs you to go to court or going to the school or do an IEP meeting for them, I'm gone. I'm going to do that. So that, looking at that institution and seeing how the growth was nurtured, you know, the funding was protected, the people were well treated such that they wanted to continue working for the agency, even in retirement or whatever. So you see institutions where people have nurtured it, cared for it, sustained it. Then you look at a Morris Brown College, which is closed because of theft by people of color. And what they stole was the education of people who might have benefited from being at that institution. And you drive by there now, the buildings are falling apart, no one's using the facilities, no one has taken the initiative to do the historic preservation fight for some of those buildings that, you know, with hand-hewn bricks and things like that. So you look at it and just say, no matter where we are, we aren't there yet. No matter, you know, if you're tired, rest, because la lucha continue, you know? You've got to continue the struggle and the fight. We have great needs in our community because we have an increased population because the nature of the problems have changed. Old solutions don't always work now. So, you know, the thinkers are needed, the philosophers are needed, the doers are needed, the people who actually get in there and do the hard work. People do ask me, why do you still deal with these kids? You could just be retired. I say, because they still need people who can provide services. You know, we can do all of these other things, but we have to realize that, you know, almost until the day we die, if you have skills, our community needs you to still be vigilant and to get up every day and say, you know, today's the day that I'm going to change somebody's life. Today is the day that I'm going to make a significant contribution to the quality of life, whether it's one person or it's an entire community. But I think a lot of times, people don't recognize their own value and don't know how to do that, to give that, you know, that it doesn't always take a lot. I love it when I see sometimes young children saying, all I had to do was be a friend to this child in my classroom who was struggling or who didn't have a friend. You know, it starts there. So, you know, how can I change the quality of some one person's life today or tomorrow? So I think we still have to be forward-thinking and recognize that we are not there. Our community is definitely not there yet. And as long as that's the case, regardless if we're 100 years old or 2 years old, not two, but you understand, very young, that we get up every day and there's something we need to accomplish and we need to recognize whatever that is and do it. Whatever we can give, we need to do it. I love, my mom is almost 90 years old, and every year she writes this check, and I know that I have to write it for her now, of $1,000 to Benedict College. That's, she can't go and serve at Benedict, but she can give. And even if she's on Social Security, her retirement, she can figure out, what can I do without that I can still donate $1,000 to Benedict, because when she went to college, she didn't have any money to pay to go to college. So, you know, because Benedict gave her the opportunity to become a teacher, to do these things, to, you know, keep her family intact, she gives back. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people don't think that way, but it is as simple as saying, what can I give up in order to be able to give back?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't need 200 pairs of shoes. I don't need the latest designer bag. I don't have to pay $200 to get my hair done. Can I use that money to support some of these institutions that are going to disappear if we as a community, if we don't wake up, like Spike Lee said, wake up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true. You actually touched on the next question I had, which is you mentioned that you said that the issues have changed, some of the community issues have changed since, like over time, and I just wanted to ask, in your opinion, how have some of the issues changed, sort of like community issues that affect people of color? Which ones have changed? Which ones have stayed the same?
Living in Atlanta, I haven't lived in Nashville recently,
mm-hmm.
but I know that living in Atlanta, we have pockets in this community where you would think that you were in an African village and not the good parts of being in a village,
mm-hmm.
where people are living without water, without safety, without electricity. They're just squatting.
Wow.
And, you know, it's because of the drugs, because of the prostitution that's here in this city. And many of them have children. The homeless population in our city is abysmal. That's the best word. It's not astonishing. I'm not astonished by it. I think at one point I was. But there are so many homeless children. They're closing at the end of August the largest homeless shelter in the city. They're going to close it down. They have no idea where the people who've been there are going to live, but they're closing it down because it's located on Peachtree Street in the center of downtown Atlanta. It's got to go. It's not good for tourism. It's not good for business. That's the attitude. But they don't know what's going to happen to these people. And the relationship between homelessness and a lot of the crime and a lot of the violence is apparent to everyone. If you don't have food, you're going to figure out how to get food to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will beg. Some people will go to the soup kitchen. And other people will steal. Then you have a real serious gang problem here. And that bleeds into the schools. And so it's a lot. It's a lot. And we have one of the lowest performing school districts in the nation is in Atlanta. I think we're 42nd. Something like that.
Wow.
So it's really horrid. It's really, I mean, on the surface, superficially, unless you, you know, really invest in the community and spend time, it looks so pretty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I live in a park. I actually live in an urban park. Lots of trees. Really older brick homes, craftsmen's bungalows. We have a swimming pool. We have a golf course. We have tennis courts. All of that. Right outside of that little ring, kind of like across the street. It's devastatingly poor. And Atlanta is not a high-cost city. The weather here, even though we have some cold days, the weather is pretty pleasant, typically. So everything would make you think this would be a wonderful place to live. Only if you have a job.
mm-hmm.
Only if you're educated. You get what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, this is hell.
Yeah.
And the gangs and all of that.
Mm.
You know, they're thriving because of issues of poverty, lack of education, lack of access to opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we can't be fooled by exterior appearances. You know, once we begin to remove that and look at the reality that the majority of kids in the Atlanta metropolitan area are not able to get a quality education through public schools.
Mm-hmm.
I have some, you know, what bothers me is when people who are on school boards say, you know, my kids attend Woodward Academy. You know, that's $25,000 per child a year.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's how they can, you know, talk about getting a quality education for their kids. My thing is, if you're a principal, you're a school teacher, then the schools that you work in or represent should be where your kids go to as well. It cannot be for those kids who have no other option.
Mm-hmm.
So we just have a lot of work to do. And it's not just in terms of school, it's healthcare, transportation, you know, all of those kinds of things. How can you have a workforce who can't get to work using public transportation? How can it be that still in this time that it is, you know what I mean, it is 2 hours using public transportation in a city like Atlanta? Because we have a subway system, but it just goes in like an X. So all of the places interior, you have to then get on a bus, and if there's a bus going there. So if you don't have a car, you may not be able to get to work. And if you don't have a job, you can't pay to have a car.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's that kind of systemic problems that we're still having in this community. But knowing that so many very well-educated, wealthy people live in Atlanta, I wonder about the communities where that is not even true. You know, at least the city has to provide a certain level of infrastructure because they have so many middle class blacks and whites who live inside the Beltway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's actually leads into the next question, which is, do you think contemporary activists and community leaders are using effective approaches to solving problems? And I know you touched on this a little bit, your conversation about the National Black Arts Festival, but in what ways do you see community leaders addressing some of these issues, which are also true in Nashville, actually, because of gentrification, like poor people are getting pushed to the outskirts of town, public transit is not very good, it can take you 2 hours to get to work. If you don't have a car, it's difficult to find work. More people are moving to the city, that makes it difficult to find work. Like, how are leaders addressing these issues in our communities? Do you think they're using effective strategies or no?
Well, we have, I want to give you my latest scenario, which is, I think, kind of speak to that question. Community leaders, we have, and I don't want to lie, I'm going to say 12 people, it's not really 12, running for mayor. Kathleen Reed, who won his first election by like 600 some ridiculous low number of votes, is ending his two-term tenure as mayor. So a new mayor is going to be elected. So all of these black elected officials are running for the mayoral seat. One straight white woman and one gay white woman. And I think it might be someone else running, maybe one white guy, I'm not sure. So the black vote, which if like 8 to 12 people were not running who were black, probably another black mayor could be elected. But they can't go into a room and say, okay, guys, this is what's going to happen. We're going to split this black vote 12 different ways. So that means none of us will be able to get elected. And Mary Norwood would be the next mayor of Atlanta. But they can't come together and say, this is ridiculous. Because those egos, their disdain for each other is such that they're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And you sit and you watch it and you know that the leaders, I mean, because, you know, I mean, we have leaders in this community of national note. You know, John Lewis. John Lewis, he no longer lives in my neighborhood, per se. You know, he's still in my district, but he used to live right down the street from me. But, you know, like John Lewis, Andy Young, you know, Reverend Lowry, all of these people live in Atlanta. And I'm like saying, if those individuals can't sit these wow people down and say, this is ridiculous for all of you to be running for mayor and know what it's going to do to this vote, that none of you will be elected, but your egos are so invested in believing, and people are telling you, you can do it. No, you can't. And you're willing to sacrifice rather than say, you know what? I'm going to step out in order, and I'm going to back this person. They're not there yet. And I'm saying all of these years that we fought, one would have thought that we were thinking this, these kinds of situations through. Mary Norwood is not a bad person. I think she'll be a good mayor. But to see how it's going to happen, I have a problem with that.
I understand.
So it's that kind of lack of leadership, lack of role modeling, how we come together to solve problems. We're not there yet, and I can't imagine that we aren't, given that this was the center of the civil rights movement. You know, you watch what goes on with the King family.
Yeah.
And you say, really? Now, I grew up, there were two boys, I was the one girl. I just could not, even, you know, I don't always agree with my brothers. We don't always say yes to the same thing, but we respect each other and we respected our parents. And my, you know, father wasn't Martin Luther King. My father was James Hopkins. My mother wasn't Coretta. She was Dorothy Hopkins. But that bad behavior that you see in the King children, somebody needed to stay home and parent those kids. You understand what I'm saying? That, you know, they're in court fighting over the Bible, fighting over the legacy, who's in charge of this, who gets this, who's going to sell that. I'm like going, if I were Martin, I would come back from the dead and just say, I know you're not acting like fools. And I'm sure Harry Belafonte has said that to them, which is why they ain't speaking to him either.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they took Harry Belafonte to court.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. And they lost.
Wow. What did they take him to court for?
Over some item or something that he had that came from their father. And they challenged him that it belonged to the estate. And he said, absolutely not. And y'all need to be ashamed of yourselves. But they weren't. You never heard that one?
I had not. I heard about, particularly like with the filming of Selma, right? Like there was so much litigation tied up in the speeches that they couldn't use the speeches.
Everything. I built a miniature version. I don't know. Did I tell you this story the last time we talked?
No.
I built a miniature version. I told you I was doing children's programming for the National Black Arts Festival. So I took the King House as a symbol to teach children about peace, justice. You know, there were 10 words that we selected. And we built all of these hands-on activities around from Dr. King's life, and we gave them copies of, you know, speeches and books. But we made it such as a teaching unit for kids coming to the National Black Arts Festival. And the centerpiece was a child-sized replica of the Boyhood Home. And I brought in a set designer, and, you know, we put the swing on the porch such that it was mounted, such that kids could actually sit on the porch and swing. The doors open, and as you come into the child-sized replica, we had a graphic artist to come in, and she painted the wallpaper because the wallpaper was no longer available. Mm-hmm. And we put a miniature couch in it, the fireplace. Over the fireplace, we put a DVD screen, and we showed films kind of like in a wraparound of King's life. And we had the house up for 5 days. And it traveled to South Carolina to the Penn Center because, of course, you know, King spent time organizing for the movement there. And we got Scholastic to give away copies of the book written by his sister called My Brother Martin. Mm-hmm. And we invited her to come and sit in the house the day that the house opened and to autograph her book and give it to kids. Mm-hmm. It appeared in the AJC, and it appeared in the AJC that morning. By 9 o'clock, I had a letter from the King family asking me to cease and desist, that I could no longer show the house because I did not have permission from the King family.
Wow.
Yeah, I had it delivered to me at my office because I wasn't out there with the kids. I was in my office, and so they delivered the letter to me. So I got on the phone, and I called. It was a nephew who had sent it, and I called him on the phone, and I said to him, I said, you do know that your mother is in the house autographing her book. So,
wow.
And he didn't even know that. He said, oh, really? Because he was saying I had, you know, it's like, Colette, you know better. You should have gotten permission. I said, this house was built on Spelman's campus, where your mother teaches. She's very much aware of the project. We coordinated it with Scholastic Books so we could have 5,000 copies of her book to give away.
Mm.
You know, nobody's being charged to go into the house. This is a free educational experience for children. Well, we own the house. No, you don't. You might own the Boyhood Home, but they don't even own that. That's owned by, you know, the National Trust. I said, no, you don't. Mm. This house is not owned by anybody. But, I mean, you know, it's that kind of ridiculous. But, you know, I went on and did what I had to do. That house, you know, toured it. Went to South Carolina. Kids loved it because they could, you know, I had children inside the house serving as youth docents.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of the children had different things that they could tell about the life of Dr. King.
Mm.
And, you know, I told them, I said, so you, what do you want us to cease and desist? The love that these kids are expressing, the education that they're getting about Dr. King, what part of this do you not want us to do? Do you not want us to give away your mother's book to thousands of children that somebody donated? You just tell me which part you don't want us to do, and I'll make sure that the Atlanta Journal and Constitution quotes you exactly. It was so absurd.
That sounds absurd, especially given the fact that his mother was a part of the project.
From conceptualization, from the beginning, I went to her at Spelman first, and she was so excited.
Mm.
I can tell you my next naughty thing. I'm teaching a class on historic preservation for kids. And one of the houses, and we're using bird houses, and it's called Tweet Auburn, like Sweet Auburn, but because they're bird houses, we have a replica of the boyhood home as a bird house.
Oh, wow.
So I'm looking to be sued again.
Oh, my goodness.
It's finished. That was the first one that we finished of the houses, was the one. Took lots of pictures to make sure that the architectural detail was exact and scaled and all of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that they're going to be like, that heifer, here we have to go again.
Wow. What happened to the child side house? Does it still exist?
Well, we don't. You know, you'd have to pay storage and all of that kind of stuff. We would do projects and have them for, like, you know, 1 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we would recycle the wood, reuse it, dismantle the projects. Because we did all kinds of things. I took a group to Nicaragua, to the Garifuna or Garifuna, depending upon where you're from, how you say it. And we built a Garifuna village with live pigs in it.
Oh, wow.
And the kids loved it. They were like, we didn't tell them that the pigs were in there, but when we were in the Garifuna villages in Nicaragua, the pigs would be under the house, and there would be a hole, like in the kitchen. You just drop your garbage down there, and the pigs took care of it. So we had the little pigs, and we had to be careful because it was so hot that summer. But the kids went from house to house looking at the different details. Nobody tried to cease and desist us. Nobody said stop doing this education stuff where you actually have experiences. And in every one of our different, you know, and like I said, I did it for 20 years. So it gave me a lot of latitude on, you know, doing different things and trying to be creative. But I always had children teaching other children. And the kids would look, how did you know all of that? Because they would have to come to like a summer institute and study and compete to be docents.
That's interesting. What made you decide to do that specifically, to sort of like train children to teach other children?
I've always loved that. When I lived in D.C., remember I lived in D.C. before coming, one of the things I loved was the Smithsonian Museum. I said, we should do this for children. No, the Smithsonian is beautiful, but the only museum that the majority of kids go to is the Air and Space Museum. Or they'll go to the zoo. And I said, what is it attractive about those? Because they're made for children. So I always wanted to have the education component of teaching about Africa and the African diaspora and African-American history and culture. From a child's perspective, how would you teach this to children where they never forget it? So every year for 20 years, I would have kids who had to do their service learning to come and do 100 hours in the summer with me. And they would come in and take the classes, and I had, you know, like college students who would teach the high school students, who would teach the middle school students, who then would be in the village teaching the kindergartners through fifth graders.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just be so, to me, I'm going to use a word that's inappropriate, but it would be so cute. Because the little kids would come back and they would say, you know, they didn't know who I am. I'm, you know, because I'm like an administrator, and I'd be walking in the village and stuff, and I said, what's that? What are you saying? Oh, no, this is in the belly. No, they were not saying in the belly. They're saying in the belly. But they would be like showing off the little jewelry they've made or how to wrap this or, you know, this artifact that they created. And they would go into their bags and they would show me, you know, we do a newsletter for the village. And this is my newsletter. One day, Stephanie Healy and I were walking through one of the facilities, and this little girl was talking to her other little girl. She said, oh, girl, I come here every year. You know, like, I was like, hey, look at this. Oh, I own this. This is my thing, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
Stephanie fell out laughing. She said, that is too cute. Like, girl, I come here every year. This is my thing. I said, look at you. Yes, your history and culture is your thing. You are absolutely correct. And but we also did the Teachers Institute so that teachers could take what we were doing in the summer back into their classrooms.
Mm-hmm. And so this was this for the National Black Arts Festival or was this when you were working at? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For 20 years.
Wonderful.
Crazy stuff. But it didn't just involve stuff for children, like, you know, you were asking me about Howard. One of the things, and I think you can still find it online, was I invited Howard Dotson in. Then he was at the Schomburg. I brought him in to have a conversation with Dwight Andrews, who teaches at Emory, and Portia Mosby, who is at, I think, at Indiana, who's a music ethnocologist. And they had a conversation about the importance of Curtis Mayfield and the music of Curtis Mayfield. And so C-SPAN came in and broadcasted. But we had it at the Carter Center, and it was standing room only. The fire marshal said, not one more person can come in here. And I love that, you know, people want to know. We would do things at the Auburn Avenue Library, like Jillian. Every time Jillian had a new book out, I would make sure that we would bring her in town to sell her books, but also to talk about, you know, where she is in the process, the writing process, the publishing process, not just the book, but how did you get there? And, you know, I would bring in other authors, children's authors, illustrators, you know, and so for 20 years, the community, I feel, was enriched because it wasn't just, go look at this exhibit. My job was to say, look at the exhibit, and now let's have a conversation with the artist about the exhibit. Or listen to the music, but now let's bring in an ethnomusicologist to talk about the instruments, the music, the period. You know, let's learn about these pieces.
Oh, wow. Wonderful. So we actually started this leg of the conversation by sort of talking about, like, leadership and the ways in which it could be better. And you cited some things like disunity is one of the obstacles towards, like, making progress, particularly like with the mayoral race, right? There's a lack of unity and understanding that, you know, you're splitting the vote, right?
They understand it. It's not a lack of understanding. They
just
understand
want to win.
It, but they're so selfish and so misguided, not willing to have the real conversation of why there are 10 black people running against 2 white women. Because you know what that's going to do and how it's going to look. But, you know, it's like we are no longer there where there's that conversation being had publicly. You know, and, yeah, so, and then, like I said, there's the other thing of people feeling as if certain things are no longer important. So priorities have shifted in terms of African-American history and culture.
How so? Like, what kinds of things are no longer priorities?
Well, I think, you know, when I see, like, the Atlanta Housewives and see the movement in that direction, you know, how we have these peaks and valleys. I think we are at a valley point in our development, that those kinds of experiences get more attention than other types of experiences in our society. We elected Trump president, and we got a lot of work to do. We're coming right after Obama. Maybe Obama was too, it was too good. We got too comfortable with thinking that it's going to be all right. So now we have a different flavor.
That's true. Absolutely true. Any other obstacles you see toward making progress?
I still think education is, I'm an educator, so it's going to be hard for me not to think about education not being critical. My husband and I are working on a new project, and we're looking at what we know about colonization and why so many African-American children are not being educated. So we're going back in history and time and looking at the work of people like Paulo Freire and trying to understand how colonialism is currently affecting education in our schools and why, as a community, we're not up in an uproar about our kids not being educated in a society where we know that if you're not educated, you are going to suffer for the rest of your life. And I'm not talking about, you know, having a PhD or anything. I'm talking about graduating from high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going to even a two-year college to get some type of training. You know, we have such a high dropout rate. We have poor school attendance. And then, you know, we have kids ending up in so much debt trying to get a four-year degree. So it's really scary that we are one of the most, you know, as I said, one of the not the most developed countries in the world. Mm-hmm. And African Americans are still a third world country within one of the most developed countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's problematic for me. So right now we're working on a project where we're looking at not just the traditional education of African-American children, but how can we use issues around colonization and theories like that in terms of helping people to understand that without and education, how our communities will look in the next decade. And mm-hmm. and because if you, you know, it's like if you're not coding or you don't understand coding, you might not be able to get a job in the technology sector, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The world, it is changing. It's changing rapidly. And the education of poor children, children of color, has not kept up with, you know. I have a, you asked me earlier about my granddaughter, and I, one of my granddaughters, and she lives with me. So she was in kindergarten this year, and she went to school, and they were talking about something about her writing, learning to write her letters. I said, first of all, she has an iPad, so very few people are writing their letters, because they had sent a practice sheet like writing the A over and over. There's no way I'm going to have, you know, a five-year-old girl in, you know, 2017 writing an A over and over. That's ridiculous. And why would you ask her to do that? Then they said, well, it will help her learn to read. I said, have you tested her reading? I said, she's been reading since she was three. I said, and, you know, I at that time, they didn't know who I was or who my husband was. I said, I've tested her. She's reading at a fifth grade level.
Wow.
Oh, she can't read at a fifth grade level. I said, any child could read. You know, that was what Paulo Freire taught us years ago. You can teach farm workers who never read anything. If you start with their reading their own name, you can then teach them to read anything. And a, when you say a fifth grade level, that means that you can read a typical American news. Paper. Not the New York Times, maybe, but you know, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is at a fifth to eighth grade level.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't even have to go out and buy expensive, fancy books. You can just pick up a newspaper and just read with the child, have the child begin to read with you. There are methods that you can use. And so when they find out, oh, yeah, she really does read at a fifth grade level.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what would make you think that I would have to lie about that. I said, but do you know that every child in your kindergarten class can read at a fifth grade level? It's taught. Oh, no, we can't teach them that because they don't learn how to read like that until they're in third grade. I said, please kill me now. But I wanted her to attend a public school. Everyone else who has kids, their kids are at Woodward Academy. I'm like, no. You're paying for these kids to go to school. You have to have accountability at the school level. You can't get this just for your child, and then the majority of children suffer. So we're getting ready to have a revolution at the elementary school. We already warned the principal that we're coming, and she's like, oh, you crazy black people. You know these kids can't learn. She's the principal.
So
it's that kind of revolution that we have to have as communities. And, you know, our consumerism. I mean, I look at what we consume and why, and I don't understand it. I just don't. I see people living in homes that is so, you know, in Atlanta, people live in these huge, big homes, swimming pools, 3 and 4 stories, and right next to them, we have kids who can't eat. You know, don't have food. We have soup kitchens, all of that kind of stuff. And so I'm like saying, why do we have to, you know, consume to the extent that you have to have a Mercedes and your wife has to have a Mercedes and your 16-year-old has to have a Mercedes? Are you really serious? You know what I'm talking about?
I do. And it's interesting that this is the Atlanta that you're describing where there are soup kitchens and homeless shelters. It's certainly not the Atlanta you see on television. That
absolutely not.
Glossed over. Completely glossed over.
You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to give you the example. The girl Portia on Atlanta Housewives. And I'm not trying to pick on her. But she has a relationship with Hosea Feed the Hungry, right? Hosea, who was part of the civil rights movement. That was her grandfather.
Yes, I remember that.
She was the one who made the comment about the Underground Railroad.
Yes.
That was so ignorant. So you know we won't, somebody failed to educate this child. Anyway, so now Hosea Feed the Hungry has to move into a new building. And that building is going to be $600,000, and they're trying to get the community to pay for this new building. Right, you know, they're going to do fundraisers and all of that to raise the money for the new Hosea Feed the Hungry facility. Portia drives a $100,000 car.
Wow.
I drive a Tercel that's almost 10 years old. Is it a Tercel? I don't even remember what it is. It's a Toyota Prado. It's a cute little car. It's a cute little car, and I love her to death. But you understand, I'm not driving a $100,000 car, but you, your family's coming to us, the community, to ask us, and you feel comfortable. She lives in a mansion. I'm like, going, are you serious? But this is what we have to come, what I feel. I don't know your values, but what I feel we have to combat as a people and as a community. So is the work of someplace like IBW, you know, how Europe underdeveloped Africa, Walter Rodney, you know, are we there yet? The answer is absolutely not. We've taken 10 steps backwards. When you can be in such a developed country where children can't read, aren't reading, graduating from high school and not reading, graduating from high school and not being able to think, you know, because think is a learned behavior. And so we're not teaching that because, you know, then they have to question, then they have to, you know, have great expectations. So I think some of it is purposeful and some of it is just neglect.
Mm. I can certainly agree with that. The next question is related, just as a general question, and I think you touched on this, particularly with, like, children and making friends and, you know, getting out into communities and educating children, but in what other ways can each of us nurture a positive future?
We've kind of gotten lost in this consumerism and materialism. My home is extremely modest. But when I say modest, it doesn't mean that it is not very nice. We bought a house that was in foreclosure, and we did it purposely. My husband had bought me a ring, and I looked at the ring. I said, you know, I really like this ring. However, we're taking it back. We're getting your money back, and we're going to use that money for a down payment on a house. We're not going to rent. And the person who was taking us out to look at houses, she said, oh, you're Dr. Hopkinson, he's Dr. Turner. And I thought to myself, oh, she's fool. She's the glitter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just want her to know that was just, this is just glitter. And I told her, I said, no, we're looking for a house that costs no more than $50,000, preferably a house that is in foreclosure, that needs work. And so as the real estate agent, she was disappointed because she really felt that she had taken us to see, you know, these gated communities where other people on our faculty live. And, you know, they paid $400,000 for the houses. Maybe on the cheap end it was $200,000. I told her, I said, we're looking for a $50,000 house in a decent neighborhood. And we found it. We found it. I mean, it's three stories above ground. It's brick exterior. Has all kinds of cute features. A full wall fireplace in the living room. You know. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not fancy, but it is nice. Two lots of land. You know, and it's in a park. But it was in foreclosure, and we got it for $50,000. We've lived in this house for 30 years.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Wow.
The idea being, you know, we still have a very nice home where, you know, ultimately when we do sell it, you know, it will, you know, help us as we age, but we are right now able to age in place.
Mm-hmm.
And we can afford it. We don't have to downsize. We already turned the upstairs into an apartment for our granddaughter and her mom to live there. We have an apartment on the first floor level as well, which, you know, can generate additional income if we need it. So it's all of those kinds of things that I think that as a people, we have to begin to think about the quality of our lives, not the quantity of our life. So in this house, there are four generations living in this one house. My mother lives here. My husband and I live here. Amasia lives here, and her mom lives here.
Mm.
And because her mom wants to go back to school, we are able to provide support. She doesn't have to pay rent. And we're able to make sure that our, not just the next generation, but the next generation after that will be able to live a quality life. And I think that thinking beyond today and myself changes how people, what people do. I don't know if that's capturing what, you know, it's that thinking beyond my generation and even thinking beyond the next generation, can we think at least two or three generations out and model those behaviors such that, you know, someone has said to me, you know, my mom has lived with me now for 20 years. They said, oh, my mom could never live with me.
Mm.
I turn and say, what? Oh, no, she's too much trouble. And, you know, when we moved in a major in her mom. And you notice how I say that, in her mom. Because her mom is not my daughter. But she needed a place to live, you know. She was spending all of her money on renting, not making any progress on her student loan debt, and not having support enough with a major with a child. I was like, why don't you come and live with us? We'll change the upstairs so that you'll have a private entrance. You'll have your own two-bedroom apartment with a kitchen and full bath and all of that. And she was like, you're kidding me. You're not serious. She became so suspicious. I said, no, I'm really being serious. So my husband went and talked to her. We're serious. Give you a chance to pay down your debt. Give you a chance to rest and breathe. Give you a chance to get your master's degree. And give you a chance to not try to be a single mom. You'll be a single mom, but you'll be a single mom with support. And, you know, when I hear people say, oh, I bet that's a mess. No, it's not. It really isn't. It really works, but you have to work it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think we can do better as a community if we begin to model new behaviors and different behaviors. I know that there are other families where there are four generations living together. I'm not talking about the ones who fight and cuss and the police are there at night.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about a plan where all of the resources can be pooled to help each other. You know, I don't have to worry about my mom being by herself.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things. So that's where I think as a community, we have to talk about it. We have to live it. You know, it's easy to criticize, but if you don't come with a solution, save your breath.
That's very true. That's very true. And a great gift to give to your daughter. I wish I had that gift.
It's not my daughter. Tamika's not my daughter. She's my granddaughter's mother. She's not my daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a wonderful gift.
It's a gift to us.
So what gives you hope? How do you maintain optimism?
One child at a time. When I have kids, one of the kids, when I went to Families First to work, one of the young people that I met was a ninth grader, and she was living in a group home. And every time I go in to meet the kids, I spend about an hour just in conversation. And I said to her, I listened to her talk. I said, oh, my God, you're a Gates scholar. She'd never heard of Gates. I said, you are a Gates scholar. She said, what are you talking about? I said, okay, she had her cell phone. I said, go on your cell phone and look it up. And she read her Bible. And she said, what? She said, I don't understand. I said, I have another little boy that I adopted who attended Morehouse as a Gates scholar. I'm going to give you his number. I want you to call him right now. And he's going to tell you what you need to do for the next 3 years. And she was, the reason that she interested me, she's in foster care, and she's telling me she's studying German. She plans to take physics. She's in Algebra 1 now, but she's going to be in Algebra 2 next year, and then the next year she'll be able to take calculus. Now, this is a little black girl that I'm just meeting who's in foster care, who's on my caseload for education advocacy. Not because she's not doing well in school, but because she's doing great. And then she tells me, I want to go to Germany because I'm studying German, and I want to go to Germany. I said, well, there's study abroad programs, so we can look at those and do this and this and this. And this little girl is in foster care living in a group home. She is now at Howard University. She is a Gates Scholar. She did spend her summer after high school in Germany. But when I met her, she didn't know what a Gates Scholar was. She knew what she wanted. You get it? That's my inspiration, is that I can meet a little girl when she's in ninth grade, and she can tell me what I consider are just kind of routine things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, studying abroad, you know, going to college, that kind of stuff. That's routine. That's what it should be, routine for kids. It's not routine for kids and foster kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, hearing her talk to me about what she wanted, she ended up when she graduated from college with all of these scholarships. And they were trying to get her to go to a 2-year college. I said, don't listen to these fools. You're going to a 4-year school. And then when I told her, you can go to school in Washington, she says, maybe I can volunteer in John Lewis's office if I get to Washington. I said, yeah, maybe you can. And she's there. She's going to be a junior this year. So next year, this time, I will have attended. Next year, this time, I'll be gearing up to attend her graduation. You understand what I'm saying?
That's wonderful.
And one of my other little girls, who I really want to choke right now today because she failed 2 of her classes, but that's a whole other story. But this summer, she went to Morocco for summer.
Nice.
She is a teenage. When I met her, she was a teenage mother. Now she's an unwed mother of 2, but she's still in college. She attends Georgia State, and she went to Morocco for the summer, which was her dream trip.
Wonderful.
So inspiration, it doesn't come from me. It comes from working with these young people and helping their dreams to come true. Can you imagine what kind of young women these women are going to be? I told them, I said, your real estate has gone up in value.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you're going to be able to do speeches all over the world about your experiences. So don't mess up your real estate.
That's good advice. Good advice. Next to the last question, which is, what specific message do you want to communicate to the younger people of the community?
I did it. Done.
Okay.
Great. There's an interview, I think, on Spelman's website that they did with me with one of my young women from foster care.
They
had brought in a recent exhibit, which was a very interesting exhibit. And so it was Muse and Mentors. What's your muse and who was your mentor? And so I brought in this young lady who everybody thought I was going to say, I'm mentoring. And what I told them, no, she's my muse. Because she inspires me to get up and do what I do every day. And so that's on the Spelman College website. I think it's still up there.
Yeah.
So that's it. That whole thing about inspiration, you know.
Wonderful. Is there anything, any other information you'd like to include we haven't touched on? Yeah, I think we had a pretty comprehensive interview. I think we're at an hour and a half now. We did a couple of hours last week. So I feel like there's some great, you said some wonderful things. It was a great conversation and certainly an honor to be a part of. So I've learned things just by listening to the life you've led and the kind of work you've done. It's really important work. So,
and it's been fun. That's the other thing. It's been so much fun.
Yeah. I think that's the thing that I would like to look back on my career and say is that I did good work, but I also enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And meeting wonderful, amazing people. You know, I tell people, you know, when I have an opportunity to go and see you know, like a play or go to somebody who's doing the last week, Kay Joy Peters, I don't know if you know her, she's a visual artist. She was doing a little talk and walking through her current exhibit. It was just like, I felt like, ooh, I felt so important. I was like, ooh, this feels so good. You know, it's like food. I was like in there licking my lips, listening to her talk about her work and looking at her work across 5 decades as an artist, a visual artist. I said, this is the food I need. Go and listen to great music. Harry Belafonte did this huge concert here. Not a concert. He created this festival. And that night, the closing act was Santana. It was an all-day, two-day weekend festival. And the closing was Santana. I had never seen Santana live on stage. And they had all of these blown-up, you know, screens where you could see everything. It was like, I said, oh, so this is why I got up today.
Yeah.
I needed to go see Santana. I need to go hear this person on the drums, or see this dance troupe, or look at this work of art. That's what feeds your soul, is, you know, having these experiences. So feed yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah, I found that to be really important, just as an artist, but as a writer, just actually coming into contact with different genres of art, like just being able to see people do what they do and do it really well is inspiring. So it's really, I've discovered in recent years that that's a really important part of creating my art, even if they're doing like music or visual art, even if we're not doing the same thing, it's really important to be able to see that and experience it. It does so much for your soul, for your creative energy. Yes.
And it just keeps you from being tired. I think your eyes look different. You smile differently if you are inspired. I think you give off a different kind of vibe around other people because you bring an energy. It doesn't have to be like you're taking over the room, but it's like, you know, you're alive. You feel vibrant. And I just think reading does it, listening to music, going to see movies, reading the newspaper. I love reading the Sunday New York Times from cover to cover. And it just makes me feel like, oh, okay, now I'm informed. Now I can look at the world.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, I think that does it for us.
Yay!
Thank you. Thank you again for participating and working with me through the technical difficulties on Monday. And this is actually, so this will be uploaded to a website. So once I have permission, I'll share with you, you know, like a copy of the interview. I'll also email you a little later today and give you my address so you can send me the consent form.
Yeah.
And yeah, we'll go from there. I really appreciate your sharing your story. I know your time is precious, and just taking time out to be a part of this project really means a lot. So
how many more do you have to do?
I will do as many as the women of IBW allow me to do.
They haven't all called you yet?
No,
I know you
yet.
Did, Pat, and I know you did.
I did. And Miss Al Josie.
And you did, what's her name? Oh, I just called
Jillian.
Her name earlier. Jillian.
Yeah, Miss Royce,
So you haven't done Lynn.
I have not, no. So what usually happens is I'll have a conversation with Mrs. Harding, and she'll say, okay, I've spoken to these people. They're expecting a call from you, so I'll reach out. Kind of like what I did with you, I'll reach out and say, hey, you know, I'm interested in interviewing you. We'll usually have a preliminary conversation. I like to make it, you know, I like to be clear on what the project's about and what our goals are, what our mission is, and how we interact with our respondents, just so everybody's on the same page in terms of what to expect. And then, you know, whenever they're free, I'll follow up with an interview. And I sent out I spoke to Aditha Douglas maybe earlier last week, very early last week. She wanted to talk to Miss Al Josie, kind of get a get some questions answered with Ms. Aljosi, and then she's like, I'll contact you again and we'll do it later in the summer. So, and I'm also, I'm not pushy. I really try because, you know, I feel like it's a gift to the project for anyone to participate. And so I certainly don't want it to feel pressured or anything. So I'm very open about, like, if you need to have further conversations before we interview, if you need to talk to someone else before we interview, I let all that stuff happen. So, but whenever someone says they're ready, I'm like, okay, when are you free? When can we do this? So,
well, I'm going to send an email out today because, you know, we meet here. You do know that the IBW mm-hmm. groups meet here frequently.
Mm-hmm.
We
mm-hmm.
just had dinner with Molly Eka. She was in town, and so there were seven mm-hmm. of us who sat down and had dinner with her. So I'm going to send out a little email to them and just say that we did this, and it was wonderful. It was fun. And kind of encourage those who haven't to step up to the plate.
Yes, okay. That would be great. Yeah, and feel free to pass along my email address. Even though I'll be traveling, I'll still be working, and I'll still be available via email and phone. So, you know, if anyone wants to give me a call or send me an email, I'm happy to talk to anyone. I really want it to be an experience that, you know, the women feel like, okay, this is something I want to do. I've decided to do this. I don't want to be.
Oh, no, I don't think that they would think it's not something that they want to do.
Mm.
But because they understand the importance of it, it's just that, you know, we get distracted
with
doing our own things.
Yeah, and I'm amazed by how busy everyone is. Like, very active. I think when Ms. Royce came to Nashville, like, she went out the night before and, like, kind of experienced, like, Broadway and, you know, went to, you know, listen to some music. And so I understand that, too, that, you know, you have lives and, you know, families. And so I also try to work around that and try to be respectful of time.
Did she tell you she just had a film to come out to?
Preciosa, am I right?
Yes.
Yeah, we did. We talked about that during the interview.
Yeah, it's going to be screened at one of the film festivals I work with at Bronze Lounge.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Yeah, we talked a little bit about writing and the process and her other, you know, how I was kind of asking her how she got into, like, filmmaking, and she talked about seeing the movie Precious, she's also inspiring, particularly as a writer, and you know, we talked about that as well. So that's exciting.
Yay. All right, my dear.
All right, well, thank you again, and I will certainly be in touch. Of course, if you have any follow-up questions or if there are things, I'm also happy, like, if there are things you forgot that come to mind later and you're like, oh, I forgot to say this, I want to talk about this, we can always have another conversation if you want to. That's totally up to you. But, yes, I'll be in touch, and you be in touch if you need anything from me.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, have a good rest of the day.
And you have a wonderful trip. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.